The opinions expressed are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official positions of the sponsors, advertisers, or presenters. Advertising does not imply endorsement by the sponsors and presenters.
Hey guys, and welcome back to the Lighting Controls Podcast. We have another fantastic guest for you today, but before we jump into everything, let me take a minute to remind everyone today's episode is presented by the LCA, the Lighting Controls Association.
And is financially supported by the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors, or NAILD. Check out our website, lightingcontrolspodcast.com. We have all of our episodes, a news feed, a merch store, a training list, which is going to be updated soon, as well as our Council on Lighting Control Startup and Integration. If you want to get involved, please reach out to us. Also, huge shout out to our sponsor for this episode today, and Ron, I'm gonna test your knowledge here about our sponsor. Okay. Do you know what DIIA stands for?
Oh, why do you gotta do this to me? Why? Why do you gotta do this to me?
It's the Digital Illumination Interface Alliance, also referred to as the DALI Alliance. These are the people who are sponsoring this episode. They're a great resource. We've had them on the show. We're going to have them on again in the future. They're really moving the needle when it comes to DALI within North American markets, but they're also just a great resource in general. DALI is a really robust protocol nowadays, especially thanks to DALI 2, which is a certification program to make sure that it's standardized throughout the controls and the interfacing with fixtures. They've got some great resources. Check them out, DALI, DALI-alliance.org. They have so much on there and there's more to come, but definitely a really great resource and we really appreciate their support for this podcast. But until you get to check them out, please listen to our episode, which is coming up right now with Daniel. Daniel, do you mind just giving us a quick breakdown on who you are and what you do?
Certainly. Thank you for the intro. So my name is Daniel. I'm the global product manager for the Dynalight hardware portfolio. I started with the group a little over 20 years ago. The company itself, we've been running for about 25 years, very much focused on network lighting control solutions. So we find ourselves in quite an interesting position, as when I joined the group, it was, I would say, more of an analog method that we were using. So that the way we would talk to lamps would be through phase cards or 0 to 10, and the way that the user interfaces would work would be all just dry contacts. So seeing when that's when I first started that that's what we're doing, to now that we're using our DALI interfaces, talking to the luminaires, querying what they're all doing and getting that feedback from the lamps, and also the transition to user interfaces where we're using RS-45 networks to the full Ethernet encryption, it's been quite a journey to sort of see that transition from the sort of the analog world of lighting control to now the fully digitalized world of our lighting control. And watching what can be done, I think it's quite impressive. But that's really what I'm hoping to sort of share with your audience today, is my experience when we transitioned from analog to digital. And by all means, there's certainly some interesting lessons learnt, some perceptions when you first go into it about, you know, why do we want to complicate our lives, but really how it is that we sort of overcame a lot of those challenges. And I think there's a lot of experience and improvements, as you said, when we went from DALI to DALI 2, exactly what that was and exactly also how it is that lighting control systems have evolved and adapted to overcome sort of, I would say, the engineer's laboratory execution of those solutions to the many applications that's now being applied to. And we've come back and said, okay, this is what we need to change. And my position within the company is that I spend a lot of time traveling. I go all over the world sort of seeing how it is that people are using lighting control and in DALI in particular, and then bringing that information back to our development team so that they have worthy targets and goals about overcoming problems, adding in features, and making sure that it's relevant.
Well, thank you so much for coming on here. I mean, that right there is a perfect summary, and I agree. I think, you know, there's that journey is a really interesting journey to kind of review and go into the details on. And I mean, to some of our listeners, I'm sure they picked up on the terms that you were using, and to others, I'm sure they were sort of like, I have no idea what he just spouted out. Like, I got 50% of that, which is fine, because, you know, I'd really like to dive into that because I think it's all really fantastic and the journey of Dynalite with all of the technology that has been incorporated throughout the years. And so, you know, again, thank you for being here. I think you're really a wealth of information for our listeners. So, let's hop in. I mean, you know, starting off with the simplest stuff, you use the terms dry contact, contact closure. You know, what is that?
Yeah, so and please feel free to pick me up. Unfortunately, I get lost in my own little jargon and
No
acronyms,
worries.
and not hang on. What are you
We
talking
love
about?
to do that in general in the controls world. We're terrible
It's true.
about consistency of definition and
It is.
terminology.
It is. I've just committed my own sin that I'm constantly trying to avoid. So, originally, dry contacts is just as simple as a light switch closure. And so this is where we're getting an interface where there will be a station on a wall, and we're just basically asking for the user interface to be the users to be able to tell the lighting control system what they need to do. And so essentially, the first user interfaces would just have a panel of buttons, and behind these buttons was just simply a switch that we would pick up that temporary dry contact input. It would then be picked up by our system and then interpreted to then perform a preset lighting function. So a very simple explanation would just be that the end user would press a button on the station. We would the system would feel that dry contact closure, and then we would then trigger a preset scene. Very, very simple stuff. Not that easy to scale, and huge complexities when it comes to wiring, because you can imagine a single dry contact, that's easy to understand. Somebody now wants to do eight buttons. Ooh, you're now starting to get big looms of wires running all over the shop, and this is where back in the proper 90s, and I would refer to it as VHS technology, it was acceptable, but we have so many better ways of doing it now using networked solutions.
Well, and you know, just to help flesh out the visual in people's minds with a dry contact, there is a thing such as a wet contact, which actually provides the voltage, as opposed to a dry contact doesn't need to provide any voltage. It's just closing that circuit. That's it. And so once that voltage transmission happens when the circuit's closed, that's when the information is sent. And so it's like, oh, circuit's complete. I'm getting a signal to do something. And so, yeah, like you said, a light switch. Light switch either severs the circuit or keeps the circuit connected, and a momentary contact or temporary contact, like you talked about, is like one of those springy buttons that you push, and as soon as you let it go, it opens the contact again.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's one parameter per contact, like you said, and so it gets cumbersome very quickly. And you know, like for instance, railroad crossings, there's like dozens of contact closures involved in this, the backup and redundancies to make sure that, you know, cars don't get hit when trains go through them. But it's a very limited capability.
Yeah, it served a purpose at the time, but absolutely, as you said, its problem is scaling, and what we're dealing with now, because the industry is having more and more scenes, more and more lighting groups, and people are wanting to be able to get that feedback. We're also wanting to be able to have touch screens, all sorts of other things, just to make the user experience more approachable, so they can get more sort of an understanding about what's happening. That technology is very limiting, and so this is where we are seeing ourselves getting into more of the addressing digital technology that is available to us today.
And so where did you go next from contact closure?
So from contact closures, we start getting into this would be our more traditional network controls. So this is where the devices themselves have sort of little mini computers within them. So they've got just a simple microprocessor. The interface is still the same. So we still have buttons that people press, but on that device itself, on that station, there is a microprocessor interpreting those button presses, and they could also be controlling indicators within those buttons. And so when the station receives a button press from the user, it'll then transmit a digital message onto the network. And this digital message can be sent to a single device, it can be sent to hundreds of devices. So it really lets us to be able to say from this single station, they could be controlling a single group, a room, or an entire building. And that is really sort of the power when we start to network devices. It allows for us to be able to call really advanced functions, so we can turn around and say that when this button is pressed, if it happens between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., do this. And we start to get into some of that logical conditions and being able to sort of allow for people to be able to select scenes that aren't too complicated. So rather than having sort of rows and rows of buttons depending about, say, this is your morning scenes, these are your afternoon scenes, these are your evening scenes, what we can do is just simply have a set of buttons, and then within the background, the network device knows what time of day it is, and then they will then automatically select the right scene. So these are just some of the ways that we're digitalizing and allowing us to overcome those sort of dry contact limitations and being able to transfer messages to many more devices. Sorry, I did probably expand a little bit more than just the sending of the messages.
Go ahead.
Yeah, but it is very much that we're able to sort of send these data packets across a digital network, when instead of having huge looms of cables of what we refer to as twin, just picking up all of those tri-contacts, we now just have a simple Ethernet cable. And right. So this here is then just sort of wired between the network devices, and they're starting to be able to then talk to each other. So the stations are not only talking back to the lighting control, the load controllers, but they're also talking to each other and updating indicator status, so that if you press button 2 at one station, another station is going to update its status and really sort of sync and make things sort of work the way that people expect. So non-lighting people expect these stations to perform. And I think that's one of the things we really need to orientate ourselves. We're lighting, we love it. We live and breathe this stuff through and through. Yep. This is just a place other people visit, and they really don't want to have to sort of know the various acronyms and jargons that we spin off all day. We must sound like we're speaking an alien language. So it is really important that we understand that we're our ultimate end customer. And I always sort of orientate this around a lot of people. Think of your grandma. I'll call it the grandma test. If your grandma can't figure this out, you failed. And that's really what we've got to wind it back to, and make sure that as much as we have these amazing tools, we've got to make it simple.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, yeah, I mean, as far as things go, you don't necessarily as a end user need to understand exactly what's happening when you push a button to make the lighting change the way that it changes. But you do, you know, as a professional, if you're designing a system, you do need to understand the nuanced differences between a contact closure and how the momentary contact of a modern button station actually is connected to a processor that's sending a data packet. And so, you know, there's a lot inside of this technology that we've advanced. Mm. It's still, I mean, really on the surface level, we're still dealing with momentary contacts, but it's not that the momentary contact is sending a dry contact signal all the way back to a processor in some central room. It's that the processor's right there in the switch. And so that momentary contact is then creating a bunch of sub-processes that are then spitting out a data string to whoever's listening for that.
And that's the decentralization that's sort of been happening, is sort of spreading the responsibility for carrying lighting control. And it's one of those things that lighting is so incredibly important and critical within any site. It absolutely has to work. So being dependent on a single processor, this is like a single point of failure, as we call it. So it's really important that we make sure that we sort of spread the responsibility to deliver lighting across as many devices as possible, just so that we have that redundancy and robustness built within the system.
Right. And so, you know, what are the best steps for that when you're working with technology to make sure that you have that in place? Because I know there's a lot of market speak out there that people will say, our system can do what you need. But like, what are the challenges to being a lighting controls designer in this scenario?
There's certainly a lot of stakeholders input. So when it comes to lighting control, designing a lighting control system, probably just if you don't mind just rephrasing it, is taking on as much responsibility as possible for the deployment of the system. So I find that when we first got involved, there were, I would say that we accessorize our way to solutions, meaning that we would have the bit that we want to build because that's what our engineers built, and then we would be dependent on external power supplies, external terminals, external bibs and bobs. And it was one of those sort of things where you take a look at an installation from 20 years ago compared to now, everything is within that one device. It is a self-supporting device. It has simply mains power coming in, direct network communication to our stations, direct network communication to our sensors. It's not passing messages between multiple protocols. There were so many different things out there that required to be stitched together in incredibly complex ways to be able to deliver. And unfortunately, I fear that that was people's first experience with lighting control systems, as they just said, there are just too many things to go wrong, too many connections that has to happen before we can even start. And I feel lighting control systems have now evolved where we are sort of building in those accessories to our devices, wearing that burden of cost, because the market is starting to realize that having these outsourced, having being dependent on installing contractors to get all of these bits right, it's too much risk. But if the lighting control system can take that all on themselves, and that's something that as the product manager, I've certainly been steering us towards, making sure our devices are fully self-supporting, that they own the responsibility. But as I said before, we're deploying and distributing the responsibility across multiple devices. So call
You've
it
done
the
it. You've
load
done it.
controls.
Yeah, you've done a fantastic job to illustrate to our listeners sort of where things started, right? And to where things are now. Because I sometimes take for granted there's probably a lot of younger listeners who may not understand, or right, never were part of a contact closure system and didn't understand that. And it's fascinating to think about the fact that for most designers, that was pretty simple, right? You button, you knew it was going to get wired to the processor. From the electrician standpoint, wiring it was easy. Yes, it was a lot of wires, but it was easy. And as we get into network systems, we've reduced the installation cost, right? We've reduced the amount of wire, but we've complicated the systems as far as programming because we've enhanced capabilities. We provide the users more often options. We're distributing that control. We then get into from the design side, there's a lot of considerations that I think it would be wonderful for you to speak about how that works for your system with the considerations of how many devices can be on a bus or on a loop or right, and before we need to distribute that again. So I think that's something that's really important for people to understand as they get into designing these modern systems.
Sure, and as you said, previously we could just use Ohm's law and a multimeter and just do sort of
Yes.
quick bell tests on the cable, and that
All
would sort of,
right. Hold on, hold on.
I've got.
Can you explain that, please?
Sorry, so. So Ohm's law is basically a formula to work out how much power voltage that you're calculating is going to be within your design. And so people are familiar with Ohm's law, voltage, current, resistance, and realize that they're the three variables that they're constantly manipulating within the formula to basically know what the cable lengths need to be, what the total load capacity is. So we will say that a dimmer output channel is so many watts. So therefore, if you're dealing with luminaires that are 2 by 26 watts, you know what the voltage is, you know when you reach the capacity. It's very, very simple math, but when you're doing the design works, it's something that you just natively pick up because it's so repetitive, especially when you're looking at projects. And so Ohm's law is just, when you do engineering, they grind that into your head for years and it just becomes a second language. So and then with multi and then with multimeters, so very, very simple device, which essentially is telling you whether or not your wire is closed or whether it is open, and using that you can fault find some of those previous conditions. But as we've moved forward in using digital, we've sort of now got into different diagnostics tools. And fair enough, I think the original diagnostics tools were designed by engineers for engineers. I think that would be the most honest way to describe them. But they weren't practical. You would need a lot of patience and knowledge to be able to drive them, and just watching essentially code, I've got to admit, would be just scrolling across the screen and you'd be expected to pick out what it is. But now we've developed a lot of diagnostics tools, still using laptops within our configuration software, but essentially going from reading code to just looking at traffic lights. So we would be showing, green, amber, red, and just being able to say whether or not we're seeing positive network feedback and response. But when it came to design, as much as dry contacts were limiting, the first network systems sort of allowed us to have over 200 devices onto a network where we went from a single device to now 200 devices. But we also needed to appreciate project scale in the way that they would be broken up, say, per tenancy, per floor, per campus. And so this is where we start getting into the way the network is designed and building in sort of methods that different islands of systems can talk to each other back to a central head-end software and sort of bring the LiDAR control system to a single flat interface, which the facility managers would use. And so those sorts of transitions, digital really allowed us to be able to sort of deliver those sorts of things, giving insight to the facility managers about how a site is running. And this is where sort of doing design work with the system, it became so much more simpler than having to constantly go back to our Ohm's law calculations of finding out whether or not we still had capacity within the line, whether there was still wattage, how many more power supplies we needed. It was a laborious task, but now with digital, it is literally what we call plug and play. I know it's a term that gets thrown around a fair bit, but it's really that's the transition that happened and really allowed us to sort of have these quick connectors that go through and let everything sort of daisy chain together.
Yeah, and so, before we move on, I just wanted to clarify a term you also used in this, which is head end.
Oh, I'm still doing it.
I mean, it's great. I love when people
No,
use
it's all
these
right.
big words because it gives listeners an opportunity to learn something if they haven't heard that term before. But head end is definitely one that pops up in our industry a lot, but I think a lot of people make assumptions about what it actually is referring to.
Sure. Absolutely. And there are certainly some different descriptions. I like to think of a head-end as like a car dashboard. And so head-end software is receiving all of that information that's happening within the network. There's a lot of network information that's completely irrelevant to other devices. So if you have a station within one area, a station in another area is going to hear the message, but it's going to ignore it because it's just not relevant to its functionality. Head-end software listens to everything. And so it's essentially tracking all of that information, and it can either represent this on a floor plan. We also use it just as diagnostic data so we can see, go through about what's happening with the communication logs. And we can also use head-end software to then issue scheduling functionality. Depending about sort of what's being deployed in site, so if they're running emergency lights, but also a good segue into DALI, a lot of the diagnostics tools to find out the status of the system. And so head-end software really sort of delivers this into something. Well, the goal of head-end software is to deliver this wealth of information into something that's readable, something that you can very quickly at a dashboard see that sort of traffic light response and allow facility managers to quickly take actions on any tasks that may be in front of them.
Right, and I think that is a really important component to the success of a lighting control system. I mean, there are a lot of lighting control systems out there with very different head-end software or very limited head-end software. And so identifying how you're going to be pulling information, how you're going to be interacting with that system, can really make or break the success of the lighting control system on the project. And as a result, the project could be a success or it could be a failure because of the capabilities or limitations of the head end. And a lot of people refer to head ends as like commissioning software or dashboards, like you said. But there are certainly custom like user interface capabilities that you could use an API, which is just a interface software allowing you to gain access to the head end. But if the head end is already limited, it doesn't matter what your custom UI is going to be. you're going to be limited by the capability of that head end. And so, looking a little bit more under the hood with DynaLite, I mean, you guys have a pretty extensive head end software.
It is, and a part of that is due to our longevity within the market. So we've been building head-end software. So one of our largest projects was the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, where we deployed one of our first generation head-end softwares, where we were monitoring that entire building. And this was before Ethernet. So it was an incredibly large scale project. And as you said before, so APIs, so this is essentially integration tools into third-party systems. We always believe that no system within a project is an island. You need to be able to make yourself transparent to other building management softwares, because as much as we feel that we're very important, it is also important that the core, as we call them, BMS systems, building management software, does have handshakes within the lighter control system. They do that through the API integrations. And it is, as you said before, our head-end software has evolved over time, understanding what people are doing and really sort of leveraging the functionality within DALI. And we have certainly learnt ways of showing a project, so making sure we can see a floor plan. We don't corrupt it with our own products. So I think it's really important that we show the project the way that people see it, facility managers. We don't want to show our devices. We just want to show the luminaires. We sort of conceal some of that complexity and noise, allowing for facility managers to get as much transparency of what they need to do. They don't need to become DynaLite experts and should conduct training, because if a lighting control system is operating correctly, it's not software that they need to interact with every day. It is only it just simply escalates to them if it's detected there's an issue. If it's found that there's a lamp failure or one of the network devices are not responding, it will just simply bring a pop-up on their BMS software asking them to go to the lighting control. So this is something we refer to as system manager, and then system manager will then have very simple, clearly described steps what the facility manager needs to do. And I think that's one of the ways that we can sort of break down a lot of the hesitation that people have with lighter control, saying, hang on, I've now got to be trained in something else. We've learned that no, we need to be able to speak a very non-engineering sort of mythology, and making sure that people feel comfortable using the tools that we've provided. We don't want to build scary stuff. We want to make ourselves as simple as a mouse click.
Yeah, and that's super important. We've spent a lot of time on the show talking about it, and we spent a decent amount just in our last episode. And I will remind everyone once again, we do not plan these people back to back. It just happens, I swear. It just happens. But we spent a lot of time in the last episode talking about, what that user experience is for a facilities manager, for, the owners, and knowing that it needs to be simple, right? We need to make things as plug and play and as simple as possible for people so that when that facility manager leaves 3 years down the road, they can in, a day, they can show the new guy that interface. He doesn't have to learn any new software. He doesn't have to go somewhere for a week to take a class. He can simply sit down, be shown by somebody else. Here's how this works because it integrates with that BMS system. And one of the big things we keep talking about too is sort of the holistic building approach and being able to tie the lighting controls into the BMS and make things as easy as possible and allow the lighting system to integrate through the API with other systems, with HVAC, with electrical, with everything, so that everything works together. And just knowing that you guys are doing that is great because that is something that's so important for people. And that's one of the benefits of DALI is if the switch fails, unlike proprietary systems, you can simply throw a new one in the wall and it's going to work. You don't have to spend all this time, being a rocket scientist to to go through the software and program a single simple device for an office. So it's great to hear that you guys are doing that. And what are some of the things that, it obviously took a while to get there. So what are some of the things that you've learned over the years through these other user experiences that really have driven you to get to that point? And then what other what else are you looking forward to in the future with your software to maybe make things even potentially a little easier for people?
Yep, so Basically, what we learned is who it is who's driving the software. And I think you hit on to a really good point there is that facility managers do change, sites grow and evolve, and we need to be able to make sure that we can grow and evolve with them. So this is very much about sort of having almost, software that doesn't require documentation, software that doesn't require training. It's intuitive. It should be as simple as any sort of Windows application. And sort of trying to actually wrap our heads around how it is that we can deliver all of the amazing functionality we have in something that's very intuitive. That's always been the sort of the challenge, is making these wonderful features accessible while not making them scary. Now, where it's probably going into the future is it's probably going to be sort of more browser app division. So this is where we're seeing from a lot of people saying that, yes, as much as we want to be able to have all of this access within our server, we also need to make it transportable. And so this is where we're looking at sort of remote sites. And so this is where supermarket chains, for example, they want to be able to see every single site and know, when they're opening, when they're closing, but they also centralize their services. So with DALI, we have the ability to query drivers and lamps and find out whether or not they're healthy, and then give that feedback. And so facility managers can simply receive these pop-up alerts, or probably not even, as we will actually send a message directly to their contracted service provider telling them that, you now have lamp A, B, and C. These are the model numbers you need to bring. You will find it in this position. So really sort of giving that rich information about what it is that they need to be able to do to service that. But this also brings in the complexity of security. And so there is a huge challenge when we're trying to make all of this information available and accessible, but we also need to make sure that we're not opening our clients to vulnerabilities. And that's really sort of where some of the challenges are coming from, is making sure that we are not the weak point in their IT security. At the end of the day, lighting is essentially a whopping great big lighthouse of a beacon for the malicious of us who would like to sort of get into these projects and cause trouble. And we have to be very aware that this is the situation we have in. It's too much of a tempting target for these people to sort of tap into. So Signify takes security very, very seriously. We have a lot of accreditations for the security that we put into place, but with the network lighting control system, we know that as we're a network system distributed throughout the whole project, we've had to make sure that various attacks are just simply not possible, whether they be from external or even internal. Our devices are now all encrypted so that we can't even, we're not even susceptible to what they call a man in the middle attack, where people will tap into our network on site just to be able to gain access to our systems. So as much as we are delivering these wonderful features of service and support, we also need to be able to do and make sure that it's done securely, that our clients aren't feeling vulnerable to sort of adopting these new systems. They're not taking on additional risks. Really, really important, especially to some of our clients who are maybe in the financial sector or even in the facility sector, train stations, airports, tunnels. These are all sites with absolutely mission critical, cannot fail, and they need to be depended on. And that's why within our system we have so many robust procedures and making sure that the delegation of the functionality is spread across as many devices as possible, that we will not fail, that there is absolutely no way of bringing our system down.
Interesting. And so, I think, a lot of people do really kind of push back on that, and they're like, well, how do I know, like, what makes me confident enough to be able to say that? What would you say to people who are kind of those Luddites who are like, well, I still don't trust it?
Yeah, no, it's a fair position to be in. It's because it is something in the background that I feel that people say is, well, we don't understand what's going on, so it's just best to avoid. And unfortunately, I do sympathize with that mindset, and we do have the onus of the responsibilities for sort of gaining people's trust. And this is where we are pursuing various accreditations. So when we're doing working for some clients, they have their own internal security procedures. So this is some of our really big internet companies. They go through and they accredit our devices independently. So much like what we talk about with DALI 2 accreditation, A lot of our clients have their own security accreditations where they do what's called pen testing, penetration testing. So this is literally, they have what's called grey hat hackers. So these are the good guy hackers, as they call them. And we will submit our systems to them where they will do their best to basically break in, penetrate that. And go through and make sure that the device, from the current understanding of vulnerabilities, is not susceptible to, and that is something that we are seeing more and more these days. That our clients are becoming more expertise in these sorts of vulnerabilities and setting up their own sort of internal IT workshops to make sure that what they're using is not going to become a liability. And I think we need to be very honest and on the front foot and allowing ourselves to be subjected to these various tests. And I'm more of an advocate that the more times that we are tested, the more times that we are challenged, the better we get. We can't be afraid of this. We have to turn around and embrace it. And this allows us to win the confidence of the marketplace that we can deliver these features securely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, we need to be testing this stuff. And I think, you know, one of the things that you keep going back to is the fact that Dynalyte's been in the game for a really long time, and you've kind of been run through the ringer in a lot of ways. So, you know, that's the added component that, you know, Ron and I keep seeing these sort of upstart companies. And it's like, okay, I get what you're saying, but at the same time, you haven't been around for very long. So how do we know, like, that you're really gonna be there? And in some cases, it's like, okay, yeah, they're backed up by a huge data management company and they know what they're talking about. But in other cases, it's like, okay, yeah, you know, where is your experience coming from?
Yeah, and that's the part of it, is that it's one thing to be able to do a calculated design within a laboratory and assume that everybody's going to do the right thing and contractors are going to put the right plug in the right spot. And it's one of those lessons, hard lessons, that we have learned, you know, from a hardware perspective, of very simple fundamental things to us now, and it's always the joy of hindsight, how designs need to work and how it is that we need to make our product robust enough to say that, okay, people are going to put excessive power supplies onto the DALI line, which will cause the and it is just one of those, it is always a what do you mean they did that moment, but they do. And this is one of those things where we say that it's never our problem, but it's always our problem to solve. And we should always sort of embrace these opportunities when they present themselves, because it is something we can now accommodate for within our system and prove to the market our ability to respond and reflect that in the design. And what I was saying before about taking on the design responsibility, the product design responsibility, and making sure we aren't dependent on external third-party devices for doing the proper thing for our system then perform its core functionality. A lot of the certification processes out there have really helped us sort of stabilize what's happening. As what we're saying about DALI 2 certification, it really was this sort of wild, wild west out there about making everyone just putting their hand on their heart saying, yes, I promise it's going to work on the day. That's not good enough. You know, we originally started off in theatrical control. And I think the saying in the theater is, if it doesn't work on the night, if it doesn't work on the night, you'll never work in this town again. And on the back of that, that's always been sort of Dynalyte's ethos, is that it absolutely has to work. We cannot let our clients down. Every single project is an opportunity to impress or, you know, die on this hill. And we really need to make sure that every single time we get this right. And on the back of that, we have thrived.
So, you know, if you had a magic wand and you could change anything about our industry, you know, what would you change?
Oof. Very good question. I would ask for the change for people to realize what's possible. I think one of the challenging parts is coming from such a feature-rich system, people aren't using it to its full capacity. And it's not that I want every single one of our projects to look like the Las Vegas Strip, but I do think that there are There are certainly, when we're starting to get into the tunable white fittings and the RGB fittings and so on and so forth, they're really starting to sort of make these advanced luminaires that were once the domain of theatres really accessible within people's homes. And I run, within my own home, these sorts of fittings and systems, because that's what I do. But it is a case that I find that once people are accustomed to it, once people feel that sort of whole, we run the lighting cooler in the morning and then in the evening we run it warmer, that becomes such an amazing experience. And I feel that people are the ultimate in clients. They're starting to be exposed to this in different places. So they may see it in their offices or they may see it in the restaurants, but they're also able to bring it into their homes and really sort of allowing people to understand exactly what's possible. But for ourselves within the industry, I would probably ask that if we could make it certainly the more of the standards we are adhering to, our better quality, the way that we communicate through the APIs, and as what you were saying before with the BMS systems, I think there needs to be more work done there in everyone handshaking and agreeing on how it is that lighting works with mechanical, works with security, works with communications. That there is a sequence that we need to work on, but to be honest, we're gravitating towards that. You can really start to see these sort of systems starting to intertwine and become more seamless. And I think that's really a very worthy goal, not only for ourselves, but also for our clients and what we can do.
Absolutely. And we're almost out of time here, so I kind of want to summarize what we've talked about. This is really fascinating stuff. And I think the real crux of the matter here, which the word that was on the tip of my tongue when you're just talking about that, was interoperability. And interoperability has really come a very long way from where it was. And part of interoperability did start with where lighting control started, when we were really dealing with more advanced systems than a light switch, which is contact closures. Contact closures are the easiest, most simplistic way of creating interoperability. And so it was very easy to just have a momentary contact on the wall that you would push, and it would activate a relay in a panel. But it's so limited in its capabilities that you could have one trigger point, but once you start getting 20, 30, 40 trigger points, it becomes so cumbersome, and you get these giant bundles of cable because you need two wires per trigger to have that work. And so finding ways of kind of encompassing that simplicity and maintaining that simplicity for the end user while providing a more robustness of lighting control system in the end market really is the goal here. And I think Dynalight really has succeeded in that. And part of it is about the infrastructure, part of it's about the hardware, part of it's about the software, and part of it's just the mindset and the necessary steps to becoming a resource for whatever project you're working on. And so sometimes that requires certification testing or standards testing so that you can really align with the needs of the owners of that space and really making that coordination possible. But at the same time, I think to your point just now, there is sort of this resistance to capability within systems. And part of it is that it's a lack of awareness of what is possible with your system. But I think the other part of it is, as we discussed, resistance to adoption of newer technology that is riskier, quote unquote. But again, that goes back to this whole how long have you been in the game discussion? And if you've been in the game for a really long time, then you've had an opportunity to see it develop over time and become better and better. And so it's not just this beta testing with people, it's actually testing your products before you even roll it out to people to use. And I'm sure there are definitely instances where projects have come up and it's like, this is really brand new stuff. Are you okay being the beta tester? But then that becomes the example to follow. going forward. And so, you know, having that customizability within a lighting control solution really gives a robust option to lighting controls designers out there. And really, you know, giving that, again, just boiling it down to that simplicity. You push a button on the wall, any number of complex events could happen thanks to a more robust lighting control system that's not just a bunch of contact closures nowadays. But, you know, having that, why am I spacing on the word now? We were just talking about it, but having the software required, headend, thank you, headend software required to maintain that information. You know, there are a lot of groups out there that have fantastic headend software to provide really complex solutions out there. And DynaLite is an example of that. So really, depending on the complexity of your system, you really want to pay attention to what you're capable of doing with that. So I think ultimately, you know, there's a lot that goes on within these systems that really worth spending the time getting familiar with the product if you want to design it. But if you want to use it, you don't need to know anything about it. You just need to know the basics of how to maintain it.
We need to know what you want. So, and that's a case
Sure.
of
Yes.
understanding about, and that's some of the things that facility managers, back in the first generation of the headend software, we would give hexadecimal values for red, green, blue. Now we show a color wheel, and this is really
Yep.
the evolution of what we refer to as the GUI, the interaction between the ultimate end user to the lighter controls. We will carry that burden of the complexity in the background, but we don't want to expose that to our clients. It'll just freak them out, and rightly so. We need to be able to make ourselves sort of as approachable, as palatable, and as friendly as possible. And I think these were some of the sins that the first computers were. I'm showing my age here, where you go X copy file, blah 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 blah. No, stop it. You really need to be able to sort of embrace that icon sort of topology, and get people to understand how it is that they can get access to it, and we can empower people. And that's really what it is about, making people feel that they are in control, not that the
Yes.
lighting is sort of dominating them. I see so many bad designs. I call them sociable sensors, where people are sitting there in their office and the lights turn off and they need to wave at the sensor to be able to get it to come back
Yep.
on. These are all horrible designs that we've done in the past, and I've got dozens of those, by the way. But it's just one of those things that we need to go to site. And I think one of the funniest, sorry, I'll just a side note, one of the funny ones, I call it the office cubicle meerkat effect. And it is a case where you need to be able to sort of change the lighting without letting people see what you're doing. Because as soon as you
Yep.
change the lighting, people freak out and they jump up out of their cubicles like meerkats. And it is just this case of, we need to be able to do what we're doing, but not let the occupant know we're doing that. So when we're doing our daylight harvesting, when we're doing our transitions of lighting scenes, long
Yes.
fade times, very
Yes.
comfortable. I'm speaking slowly for a reason. And we need to be able to sort of understand that these are the things we need to be able to engage to say, yes, we need to transition from here to here. But the idea is we need to do it covertly. No one should see what we're up to. The idea of
Right.
automation is no one notices. We need to be able to keep ourselves within that mindset.
Yeah, and it's so important because you mentioned earlier the Vegas thing, and that comes up all the time. Every time I go on site and you talk to the client, ask them what they want, they go, "Oh, well, we don't want Vegas." And as an industry, whether you're a designer, you're the programmer on site, whoever, we need to do a better job about showing the end users what the systems are capable of. Like, sure, you can show them the extremes, and that's fun. But making sure they understand that no, this fade is going to happen over 30 seconds or 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and you're never going to see it. You're not even going to know. We're going to do daylight harvesting, and that's going to be a 10-minute drop, and we're going to wait 2 minutes to make sure that it wasn't a truck blocking the sensor and it was not a cloud just passing by. So we're going to wait 2 minutes and verify that happened before we even start dimming the lights down and getting people to understand that all this happens in the background. And showing them what's capable, and here, we're going to give you a warmer light in the morning. And when you walk into your office at 9 a.m. or a cooler light, sorry, you're going to walk into your office at 9 a.m. and we're going to start and things will be a little cooler. And as you go through lunch and then as you go towards, you know, 4 or 5 p.m., we can start to warm things up again to send people home and, you know, and just showing people what's possible. And that is, it's really all of our responsibility, right? It's designers, it's programmers on site. In order to gain that adoption so that people don't just have that initial reaction of, we don't want Vegas, because that is the initial reaction that we run into of the time. So you make some great points. And the grandma's test thing is great because you're right. If your grandma can't operate it, then we failed. And that's very important. Mm. And obviously that's taken hold in your software as well. And I really appreciate that. So I think it's great. Go ahead.
No, but even with our user interface, so our station, so I remember when we first developed our current flagship station called Untumbra, the engineers came back and says, okay, it needs to be 16 buttons. Sorry, what? And I was like, oh, well, and you know, engineers speak 16 buttons because that's a hexadecimal system that they work with. And I very much just pushed maximum six. If you can't do it in six push buttons, you are overcomplicating this. And most of the time it's four. Why would somebody need to see more than six buttons, let alone 16? So we've got to make some of the decisions on behalf of our customers and just say, look, here's your presets. And as I said, make it as simple and as appropriate. And that was really the big goal of Untumbra, to say, I want a crisp, clean interface that looks like it's easy to interact with. It has to be. So that was the goal.
Yeah. Yep. And so, I mean, you guys really hit it on the head. It really does come down to a lot of these jobs, a lot of, you know, just moving forward in the industry comes down to experience, and companies who have been around longer and had people who have been through this experience really does matter. And knowing that you guys are really, especially with Signify at the helm, right, really focused on safety and security as we move into more cloud-based systems or remote access is vitally important for people to understand and know that these systems are safe so that they can have that access that they want. And it's very important for people to get that. So Dan, really, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a fantastic conversation and really appreciate you taking the time, knowing for those of our guests who don't realize, it's 5 a.m. for Dan right now. So he got up extremely early to be here with us, and we really value and appreciate your time. So thank you so much.
Coffee's the trick. It's awesome.
Right, so there you go. I will just take a minute to remind everyone, today's episode is presented by the LCA, the Lighting Controls Association.
And it's financially supported by the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. Also, check out our website, lightingcontrolspodcast.com. We've got all of our episodes, news feed, merch store, trainings, as well as our council that we're starting up. Check it all out, as well as check out our sponsor for today's episode, the Dolly Alliance, also known as the Digital Illumination Interface Alliance, DIIA. We mentioned it a lot. Or at least their product a lot inside of this episode. And if you're curious, you should go to dali-alliance.org, where they have a lot of information about Dolly 2 compliance, D4i, all of the good stuff that is coming out from the Dolly world, and definitely worth checking out if you're unfamiliar with it. You know, great technology, as we mentioned on this episode and in previous episodes, you know, really worth your time to check it out. So thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, Daniel, thank you so much. Really appreciate you joining us. This was a great conversation.